President Trump bans travel by Europeans into the U.S. for 30 days in response to the coronavirus outbreak. Today is Thursday, March 12th. This is WBUR's Morning Edition. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Coming up, the White House travel ban for people from the EU. It begins tomorrow. Without citing evidence, President Trump last night blamed Europeans for spreading the virus here.
The European Union failed to take the same precautions and restrict travel from China and other hotspots. As a result, a large number of new clusters in the United States were seeded by travelers from Europe.
The president's address sent overseas markets reeling after the massive losses on Wall Street yesterday, and the U.S. markets point down again today. Also this hour, how Boston area workers who can't telecommute are working during the outbreak. Forecast mostly cloudy, low 40s today. It's 7:01. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump is issuing new rules to deal with the spread of the coronavirus. On Wednesday, he said the U.S. will ban incoming travelers from Europe, except for the United Kingdom. Americans and legal residents are not subject to the ban. He's suggesting proposals to deal with the economic fallout. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Trump had advice about the virus for older Americans.
Speaking from the Oval Office, President Trump told older Americans to be very, very careful and avoid non-essential travel.
In particular, we are strongly advising that nursing homes for the elderly suspend all medically unnecessary visits. In general, older Americans should also avoid non-essential travel in crowded areas.
Trump said he would defer tax payments for individuals and businesses in certain areas. He said those measures would add more than $200 billion in liquidity to the economy. He is also calling on Congress to consider a payroll tax holiday and would seek an additional $50 billion to help with loans for small businesses. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
The National Basketball Association has suspended its season. The NBA decision came after a player for the Utah Jazz tested positive for the coronavirus. Dwayne Casey, head coach for the NBA's Detroit Pistons, says the league is acting to protect its members.
It's always been where you could lean on sports to kind of ease your nerves or ease the situation. But now we're just like everyone else. We're involved. We're looking out for each other, looking out for fellow team members, our families. So I think this is unprecedented territories for the whole sports world.
Meanwhile, the National Hockey League says that it will update the status of its season later today. At least two NHL teams say they will host some home games this month, but fans will not be allowed to attend. Two American service members have been killed in a rocket attack on an Iraqi training base just north of Baghdad. NPR's Tom Bowman has more.
18 rockets slammed into the Taiji training base just north of Baghdad, U.S. officials said. Besides the two Americans killed, a British service member also died in the attack. At least 12 coalition service members were wounded, two seriously. There are more than 500 Americans at the base. There was no word on who is responsible, but speculation centered on Iranian-backed militias, which have repeatedly targeted coalition personnel. The deadly attack came as U.S. officials said they were already speeding defensive equipment to U.S. bases in Iraq, including the Patriot system designed to shoot down ballistic missiles and a separate system that targets rockets and drones. Tom Bowman, NPR News, Erbil, Iraq.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston with the latest on coronavirus news. Members of the state's all-Democratic congressional delegation are criticizing the president's new travel ban. Congressman Jim McGovern says COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus, is already in the country, so he says the focus should be on supplying more tests for it. Senator Ed Markey says President Trump should instead declare a federal emergency so states can get funding to fight the virus. Logan Airport officials say they're evaluating what the travel restrictions mean for them. Massport says it's working with both airlines and federal authorities to understand the impact of the president's new travel ban. The State Department of Public Health now reports 95 cases of COVID-19 in the state. Also, more than 400 people are being monitored or are under quarantine. Several local schools are closed. In Boston, three campuses of the Elliott School will be closed through next week because a member of the school community tested positive. That person was not a student. All schools in Framingham will be closed tomorrow because an elementary school parent tested positive. WBUR's Kerry Young reports that person's child also attended school with mild symptoms of an infection.
The child and the family are following the state's recommended quarantine protocols. School leaders say they've also identified a group of students who could have been infected and placed them in a 14-day quarantine. Superintendent Robert Tremblay says while the Potter Road Elementary School is the only one directly affected, he's having all district schools disinfected out of, quote, an abundance of caution.
As always, the safety, health, and security of our students is our top priority. We continue to work closely with all relevant state and city departments to respond to this evolving situation.
The district is also planning a Facebook Live event tomorrow to give parents a chance to ask questions. Schools are expected to reopen on Friday. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Carrie Young.
One more school note. The Lincoln School in Brookline is closed today and tomorrow because a parent of a student there tested positive. Brookline town officials say two residents tested positive. Both are in isolation. The town is also banning non-essential meetings at town or school buildings until the end of April. The Encore Boston Harbor Casino in Everett is implementing safeguards. The casino says workers will soon begin taking the temperatures of guests and staff members when they arrive, and anyone with a temp of 100 degrees or higher will not be allowed in. The casino is already disinfecting slot machines, handrails, and ATMs hourly and is changing chips and cards at tables every 4 hours. Stay with WBUR through the day today for the latest developments on coronavirus. You can also get the latest at WBUR.org, including how virus fears are affecting the arts and culture scene in Boston. The time is 7:07.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Xfinity, offering Internet customers wireless service for the whole family with Xfinity Mobile. More at Xfinity.com. Boston Ballet's Carmen, celebrating the creativity, power, and beauty of women, now through March 22nd. Tickets at bostonballet.org. And Subaru, the redesigned Subaru Outback, has standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and 8.7 inches of ground clearance for all weather conditions. Love. It's what makes Subaru, Subaru at Subaru.com.
Sports, the Celtics game planned for tonight in Milwaukee is canceled, along with the rest of the NBA season for now. As you've probably heard, the league suspended its schedule last night, its entire schedule, after a Utah Jazz player tested positive for coronavirus. The Celts fly home from Milwaukee later today. Forecast, more clouds and sun today, should reach the upper 40s. Tonight, cloudy with a few showers, lows down around 40 degrees. Wet Friday ahead, showers tomorrow in the upper 50s. Sunny for Saturday and Sunday. It'll be right around 50 on Saturday, then close to 40 on Sunday. In Boston now, 35 degrees, 32 in Worcester, 33 in Salem, and 31 degrees in New Bedford at 7:08.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm David Green in Culver City, California. A pretty dramatic announcement from President Trump in the Oval Office last night. He banned most travel from Europe to the United States for 30 days beginning tomorrow night. The president said he is trying to slow the spread of the coronavirus.
After consulting with our top government health professionals, I have decided to take several strong but necessary actions to protect the health and well-being of all Americans.
The president also announced measures to shore up an economy that has been shaken by this outbreak. And I want to begin with NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Hey, Franco.
Hello.
So how far does this ban go?
Well, the president is imposing a significant ban on travel of foreign nationals from Europe to the United States. The president said these measures are necessary to protect Americans, but he was also casting blame on the Europeans.
The European Union failed to take the same precautions and restrict travel from China and other hotspots. As a result, a large number of new clusters in the United States were seeded by travelers from Europe.
This was really a rare Oval Office address. It was also some of the strongest comments yet that the president has made about the virus after weeks of really downplaying the threat. You know, there's still a lot of questions about what these measures mean. And frankly, the president added to the confusion last night. He originally, in his address, said this would include goods and cargo, but the official proclamation made clear that it would not impact trade and only people. The administration was also quick to clarify that these measures did not apply to Americans, legal permanent residents, and people from the UK.
I want to underscore, you said to the president blaming Europe. I mean, it's not clear what role European travelers are actually playing in the spread of this disease. And European officials, some of them were angry and caught off guard. The president, we should say, has been criticized for his initial response to this disease. He's trying to show he's on top of this. And in part of that doing last night, he announced measures to shore up the economy. What exactly is he talking about?
Right. He is taking steps, he says, to help workers who are sick, who need to be quarantined. Trump said he would also defer tax payments for individuals and businesses in some of these, you know, impacted areas. And he's looking, at least, to provide billions in loans for small businesses. And he wants Congress to consider a payroll tax holiday. But really, there's a lot of questions about those economic measures because it's really unclear how they will be made. And we're seeing that already with troubling signs in the global stock market.
And what is the reaction so far on Capitol Hill to some of his proposals?
Well, the reality is the administration has received little buy-in from Democrats and actually some Senate Republicans as well. The big question is, how is the administration going to pay for something so expensive as, for example, the suspension of payroll taxes? In House Democrats, they've also already introduced their own bill. They did that last night to combat, you know, the economic impacts of the virus. You know, and this measure would include free coronavirus testing, paid emergency leave for workers, and help for states who have been overburdened by Medicaid costs.
Okay, that's NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez talking about the president's address last night from the Oval Office. Franco, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Joining us now is Dr. Margaret Harris of the World Health Organization's Coronavirus Response Team. The WHO has now characterized the coronavirus as a pandemic. Dr. Harris joins us via Skype from Geneva, Switzerland. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me, Rachel.
The WHO is very cautious about using the term pandemic and had used caution for weeks now when it comes to the coronavirus. What triggered this decision to now call it a pandemic?
What's really changed is we've been saying for weeks and weeks, get ready, prepare. This virus is going to be coming to your communities. Get your health systems ready, get your people ready. What's changed is we are now saying it's here. So we've gone from get ready to get active, get serious. Now we all have to accept that we have got the virus or will get the virus soon in our communities. So we need to take the actions that will stop it, and that is identifying the virus, identifying people infected with the virus, identifying people who've been in contact with those infected with the virus, and being ready to look after the people who get severely ill with the virus.
But I guess I'm wondering, the metric by which you define something as a pandemic, is it the number of cases? Is it the number of countries affected? Is it the rate of the spread?
It's a bit of all of those things, but the important thing is where it is and the type of spread. So when we started to see widespread, you know, significant community outbreaks in a number of different parts of the world and very concerning outbreaks. So we're seeing very concerning outbreaks in Europe. We're seeing this in the Americas. We're seeing emergence in Latin America. We're seeing emergence in the Pacific. So essentially we're seeing outbreaks of concern around the world. We've got more than two-thirds of the global population, countries representing two-thirds of the global population now reporting cases. So for us, that means that is the tipping point at which we need to advise the world this is now characterized as a pandemic.
Can you still contain the virus, or is it just about mitigating its effects at this point?
We're really talking about blending. So you're quite right to use those words, contain and mitigate. Contain is identifying everybody who's got the virus, identifying everybody who's been exposed, working with them to stay, to self-isolate, stay out of the community, stop spreading it. But also you have to accept that people are going to get sick. You are going to see some cases that you haven't identified. So you need to mitigate those effects. You need to be ready to treat the people who get very ill.
What else needs to happen right now on the testing front or on restrictions to behaviors, businesses closing? I mean, we're seeing things kind of happen ad hoc in different countries. Does there need to be a more unified response?
Certainly testing is very important because the symptoms, as everybody has noted, are not that obvious. A lot of people have what we call a mild case. So many people who've had the cough tell me that didn't feel mild at the time, even if they were classified as having a mild case. But some people do report very, very few symptoms. So testing is really the only way you can be sure that people have the virus and also then make decisions about asking them, isolating them, but also asking those around them who may have been exposed to self-isolate and also look out for symptoms. The other crucial thing is social distancing, because we know that this is carried by droplets and that the droplets tend to fall within 1 meter of the person who's carrying them. And as I said, they may not be aware at all. They may not feel ill. They may simply be breathing out droplets, or when speaking, you know, we all test every now and then, we spray rather than say. We can't help it. But those droplets fall within a meter of that person. So if we can keep separate, if we can give up sort of the desire to be together in large crowds for a while, we can really limit the spread. So that's where government decisions about how to achieve that by asking people to work from home, by reducing the number of people who will be on transport, by limiting the mass gatherings or even stopping mass gatherings, all those things can make a huge difference.
Dr. Margaret Harris is part of the coronavirus response team and a spokesperson for the World Health Organization. Thank you so much for your time.
And thank you.
Harvey Weinstein was rushed to Bellevue Hospital in New York last night. A spokesperson told NPR it was for ongoing heart problems and a complication related to his back surgery. Just hours earlier, a New York judge sentenced him to 23 years for a rape and a criminal sexual act against two different women. It was a stunning fall for a man who had once been a powerhouse in Hollywood. NPR's Rose Friedman was in the courthouse for the sentencing. Just a warning here, this piece does contain some discussion of sexual violence.
Judge James Burke handed down close to the maximum sentence for Weinstein, telling the courthouse, quote, "There's evidence before me of other incidents of sexual assault involving a number of women, all of which are legitimate considerations for sentence." Six women sat in the front row facing the judge, six women who had testified that Weinstein had raped or assaulted them. He violated, quote, "my trust, my body, and my basic right to reject his sexual advances," said Miriam Haley. Weinstein will now be in jail in New York before going to a state prison. He's also awaiting extradition to Los Angeles, where he faces four more charges against two different women. Bennett Gershman is a law professor at Pace University.
What typically happens with extradition is the state that is seeking to have the defendant extradited makes a request. It's a cooperative effort.
Weinstein's legal team could challenge his extradition in court, but Gershman says there are reasons why many defendants don't do that. They don't want to cause trouble with the new jurisdiction, in this case, Los Angeles.
Rather than challenging and, you know, interfering and causing a lot of, you know, disturbance with the other system, they may feel that they get a better, you know, they're treated better.
And while that's going on, Weinstein's New York legal team says they'll appeal his conviction. After the sentencing, attorney Donna Rotunno spoke to reporters on the courthouse steps. She listed some of the reasons she sees for an appeal.
You know, I think from the very beginning of this case, from the ruling on the Molinaw witnesses, I think the way that the jury was selected, the fact that we asked to question people individually, discovery violations, Sandoval, juror number 11, extreme sentences, so we can go on and on.
Throughout the proceedings, Weinstein's defense team said they did not think he was getting a fair trial and called for a mistrial many times. After the sentencing, many of Weinstein's accusers expressed their satisfaction with the outcome. Rose Friedman, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR. Thanks for coming to us this morning. Ahead on Morning Edition, more on President Trump's coronavirus economic measures to provide relief for workers under quarantine, and the oil price and production fight between Russia and Saudi Arabia that sent prices tumbling and has contributed to the shaking of the world stock markets. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Applied Biomath, applying mechanistic mathematical modeling, simulation, and analysis to accelerate and de-risk drug R&D. More at AppliedBiomath.com. And Fidelity Investments, reminding you it's never too early to start saving for your child's future. Learn more about a tax-advantaged 529 college savings account and how you can use the money to pay for qualified expenses at Fidelity.com/ufund. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
Now the forecast. It turns gray today. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
A lot of clouds for your Thursday. I can't rule out a little sun. It's cooler. We're up near 50, a wind off the water. Tonight, mostly cloudy skies. There might be a shower toward morning. Temperatures 38 to 42. On Friday, showers. It warms up later in the day with a southwesterly wind. Those showers could yield a heavier downpour. Not a lot of rain. Temperature 60, maybe even as high as 63. On Saturday, sunshine near 50. Sunday, sunny, mid-40s. Monday, sunny, low to mid-40s.
In Boston now, 36 degrees. Subscribe to the WBUR Today newsletter to get Dave's forecast every weekday in your inbox.
You are being watched all the time from space by a spy agency that most of you have never heard of.
Most people understand that some of their information is being monitored, and we just have to recognize that there's an ability to observe more from space than ever before.
That, plus the latest on the coronavirus outbreak, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on 90.9, and when you ask your smart speaker to play WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Capital One and Walmart, offering a credit card that can be used for a range of uses, from shopping at Walmart to travel purchases. Details about the card's features are at CapitalOne.com. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Progressive Insurance, committed to protecting cars and drivers, whether on the open road or having a driveway moment while listening to NPR. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from Visit St. Pete Clearwater along Florida's Gulf Coast, offering a variety of museums, including St. Pete's Dalí Museum, Chihuly Collection, and the Museum of Fine Arts. More at visitstpeteclearwater.com.
This is WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. As concerns about coronavirus and the number of cases grow, medical professionals are taking special steps to protect their most vulnerable patients from the pandemic, especially those battling cancer. Dr. Greg Bunnell is Chief Medical Officer at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He joins us now to talk about how his institution is keeping its patients and cancer survivors safe from coronavirus. Doctor, thanks for speaking to WBUR. Morning Edition.
My pleasure. Good morning.
So start this way, if you would. Remind people why cancer patients are at higher risk than others to coronavirus.
We're especially concerned about our patients with blood malignancies, diseases like lymphoma and leukemia and multiple myeloma, who we think may be at greater risk because those diseases and their treatments disproportionately affect cells of the immune system. But we're also concerned about our patients who are in active treatment for any type of cancer because of the effect on the immune system.
What about cancer survivors? Are they considered equally vulnerable to the virus, even though they're not currently in chemotherapy or other treatment?
The data are evolving in this area, but clearly those at greater risk are those with hematologic malignancies and those in active treatment. As people get further from their treatment, they have reconstitution of their immune systems, and that risk wouldn't be as great.
So then what specific precautions is Dana-Farber taking to keep patients safe?
We have been preparing for this for weeks. We activated our Hospital Incident Command Center back in January when early reports started coming out from China. Weeks ago, we began calling and screening our patients before they even come to their appointments, and we screen them again when they arrive for a history of travel, for possible exposures, for symptoms. And the staff have been trained to know how to respond to the different scenarios. We've taken a number of other steps to protect our patients and our staff. We've restricted the presence of individuals in buildings in which patient care takes place to only employees directly involved in care delivery and to patients and their families and caregivers. And we've asked patients to limit the number of family members or caregivers who come with them to one person unless it's necessary for care of the patient. Our approach continues to change every day as we learn more and as the situation changes.
Do you know if anyone undergoing treatment at Dana-Farber has actually been exposed to the virus?
So to date, we haven't had any confirmed cases in any of our patients or in staff. It's a scenario that we've been preparing for.
How concerned is everyone about this? What have you been hearing from patients and doctors at the Institute about the outbreak? How concerned are you?
I think everyone is concerned about this, including our patients and their families and our workforce. And we and I share that concern. And it's why we've really taken additional, very aggressive precautions to keep them safe and why we'll continue to do so as the situation lasts.
So what advice then do you have for patients, doctors, and families at this time?
Number one, wash your hands. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Don't touch your mouth or your eyes. We want people to avoid shaking hands, to avoid direct contact with other sick people. I think everybody out there is anxious about this, and we should channel that anxiety in a way that helps us to try and stay healthier by exercising good hygiene, eating right, and getting plenty of sleep.
Dr. Craig Bunnell, Chief Medical Officer at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, thanks a lot for speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition.
My pleasure. Wash your hands.
The coronavirus outbreak is laying bare some of the inequities in the American workforce. Many white-collar workers can do their jobs from home and are doing so to protect themselves. And if they do get sick, they have paid time off. But for others, telecommuting is not an option, and missing work because of illness may mean missing a paycheck. WBUR's Callum Borchers reports that one example of this imbalance is at the center of this state's coronavirus outbreak.
When you step off an elevator in the Boston Marriott Long Wharf Hotel, the gleaming lobby looks like it's just been scrubbed, and it has. A worker swabbing surfaces with Clorox wipes quips, this is probably one of the cleanest places in Boston. There's a reason to be vigilant. Public health officials say this hotel is where an employee of the pharmaceutical giant Biogen infected several colleagues with the new coronavirus late last month. This transmission is driving the vast majority of Massachusetts cases, and Governor Charlie Baker this week called on the business community to help stop the spread.
Our administration is moving forward with enhanced guidance for employers and large organizations. Responding to this evolving health threat requires everyone to be vigilant and for everyone to be part of this effort.
The guidance includes avoiding large gatherings, if possible. But that didn't come in time to prevent some of the Biogen executives who attended the Marriott Long Wharf conference from speaking at another healthcare event in a different Boston hotel a few days later. In a recording posted on the company's website, you can hear someone in the group coughing as a moderator introduces Biogen leaders.
We're happy to have with us today Michelle Venoussos, the CEO, as well as Joe Myra from IR and Jeff Capello, the CFO, here in the front row. Michelle, maybe you can start with just giving...
Biogen employees are now working from home, and those who've contracted the coronavirus can likely take time off without losing money because the company offers ample paid sick leave. But the hotel workers who serviced Biogen employees in recent weeks may not be so fortunate.
Given the current situation with the coronavirus, one of the things we're concerned about is, in our industry as a whole, paid sick leave has been a big challenge.
This is Carlos Aramayo. He's the secretary-treasurer of Unite Here Local 26, a union that represents thousands of the state's hospitality workers.
A lot of folks feel like they, you know, got to power through that cold to come in to work, or feel like they need the money, right? And some of the recommendations we've seen from the CDC is that sometimes people need to take up to 2 weeks. And that's a lot of time for folks on an hourly basis to potentially lose significant income.
State law guarantees some paid sick leave for most workers, but not enough to cover a prolonged absence. And in an Oval Office address last night, President Trump said a federal solution could be coming, but offered few details.
This will be targeted for workers who are ill, quarantined, or caring for others due to coronavirus. I will be asking Congress to take legislative action to extend this relief.
Unite Here Local 26 says it may use a fund normally reserved for strikes to pay workers who miss time. But that won't help employees of the Boston Marriott Long Wharf who are not unionized. Hotel managers didn't respond to interview requests, and employees say they're not allowed to speak to the media. The worker with the Clorox wipe says many employees have worked at the hotel for more than 20 years and have amassed enough paid time off to be okay. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
This is WBUR. Ahead on Morning Edition, the NBA's move to suspend the rest of the basketball season in the coronavirus outbreak after a Utah Jazz player tested positive. On our website, WBUR.org today, find a story on how coronavirus is affecting the U.S. pharmaceutical supply. That story and more today at WBUR.org.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. Prepare for a dynamic career with a master's in mental health counseling. 94% of grads hold clinical jobs or are in private practice. The program exceeds state licensure requirements, and the GRE is not required. Located on Boston's Green Line, bgsp.edu. And Guardian Insurance, because everyone deserves a Guardian. GuardianLife.com. Guardian is a registered trademark of the Guardian Life Insurance Company of America, New York, New York.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The spread of the coronavirus is prompting President Trump to impose a 30-day travel ban on most Europeans entering the U.S. The ban does not apply to Americans, legal permanent residents, or their families. NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin says the announcement caught many European officials by surprise.
European ambassadors to the U.S. said the White House failed to warn them about this ban in advance. European Union Council President Charles Michel asserted in a tweet that Europe is taking all necessary measures to contain the spread of COVID-19 and that the EU would assess the impact of the travel ban today, ensuring that economic disruption can be avoided.
The National Guard is due in New Rochelle, New York today as a result of the coronavirus. This follows a decision by the governor to close schools and houses of worship in the suburb of New York City. Jake Offenhartz with member station WNYC reports.
The National Guard will begin cleaning surfaces and distributing food to those living within a one-mile radius of a synagogue at the center of the outbreak. Locals have hung purple ribbons of support around the empty building. The measures come as officials scramble to contain more than 100 confirmed cases linked to the area. Those not in voluntary or mandatory quarantine can come and go as they please. Some New Rochelle residents say the response has increased anxiety and hurt local businesses. For NPR News, I'm Jake Offenhartz in New Rochelle, New York.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston with the latest on the impact of the coronavirus here. The State Department of Health now reports 95 cases of COVID-19, the disease caused by coronavirus. More than 400 people are under quarantine right now. Another 600 have already completed their quarantine process. Three campuses of the Elliott School in Boston are closed through next Thursday to allow for cleaning. This after a member of the school community who is not a student tested positive. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh says there are no other closures right now.
We're not ready yet to talk about canceling the district-wide, but we are putting plans in place right now that in the event that we have to cancel or postpone school, we will have all the proper procedures in place.
Schools in Framingham are also closed today because a student's parent tested positive, and the Lincoln School in Brookline is also closed today and tomorrow. Several more Massachusetts colleges are moving to online classes to prevent further spread of the virus. Brandeis and the New England Conservatory will begin online classes only later this month. Williams College says it's dismissing students for spring break this week, 1 week earlier than scheduled, and will move to online learning on April 6th. Nursing homes in the state are facing new state restrictions to guard against the risk of coronavirus for older adults. People are now banned from visiting nursing homes if they traveled internationally in the past 2 weeks or if COVID-19 is spreading throughout their community. The restrictions also ban visitors who show symptoms of respiratory infection. Stay with WBUR and NPR through the day today for the latest on developments in the coronavirus story. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and on Instagram at WBUR. Sports: Celtics say they'll fly home from Milwaukee today after the NBA suspended play league-wide last night. The move came after an NBA player for Utah tested positive for coronavirus. There's been no word yet on what the NHL might do. The Bruins' next game is tomorrow in Buffalo. Spring training: Red Sox beat the Rays 3-1 last night and play the Rays again tomorrow. The Boston University men's basketball team will play in the NCAA tournament for the first time in 9 years. BU beat Colgate 64-61 yesterday to win the Patriot League title. Forecast: we get a mostly cloudy day today with a few sunny breaks. Highs today in the upper 40s. Cloudy tonight, lows around 40. Showers tomorrow through the day, upper 50s on Friday. Saturday, partly sunny and near 50 degrees. Sunday, sunny and in the low 40s. In Boston now, 35 degrees. 31 in Westboro, 37 in Gloucester, and 35 degrees in Fall River at 7:36.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Standard Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling, owned and operated in Dorchester. Boston Standard is an independent, trained comfort specialist dealer. BostonStandardPlumbing.com. C3.ai. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And Indeed, with its skills tests, built for employers who want to see a deeper sense of the person behind the resume. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The NBA has suspended its entire season. That decision came last night after a player with the Utah Jazz tested positive for COVID-19. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman is following this and joins us this morning. Hi, Tom.
Strange times, Rachel.
Strange times indeed. I mean, this was crazy last night. I mean, fans were in the stands waiting for the start of this Oklahoma City Thunder game against the Utah Jazz. And then what? Officials just came out and said the game's off. Everyone go home?
Let me take you back a little bit before that. Utah All-Star center Rudy Gobert had been sick. He'd had symptoms that led to tests for influenza, strep throat, an upper respiratory infection, and the tests were negative. And as a precaution, he was tested for COVID-19. That came back positive. Now, according to The Athletic, he's feeling good, and even though he says he could have played last night before that Utah-Oklahoma City game, they said no. The game was called off right before tip-off, after the test result came back. Another game called off when it was learned that one of the refs had worked a Utah game a few days before, meaning he was potentially exposed to the coronavirus. And soon after all this, the NBA said, that's it. We're suspending the season.
Have they said anything more? I mean, what's the rationale, I guess, for the decision in this moment? I mean, you would think that it happened so dramatically, I guess.
It really did. You know, the NBA hasn't answered directly why it jumped from these games to suspending everything. But what we know about the coronavirus spread, you know, it's person to person, people who are in close proximity to each other. And basketball players obviously fit that description.
Right.
According to ESPN, 34 players shared the floor with Gobert since last Friday, and they have lots of questions and concerns about who came into contact exactly, who might have gotten the virus as a result. And not just the players, but all the people they might have come in contact with as well. You know, so you see the potential mushrooming characteristic of this. So the season suspended. The NBA says it'll use this hiatus to determine the next steps for moving forward in regard to the coronavirus pandemic.
What's the response been like to this decision?
Well, outside the NBA, we've heard from at least one professional sport, the National Hockey League, which says it's continuing to consult with medical experts. It's evaluating the options, and the league expects to have a further update today. Inside the NBA, you know, the words you're hearing are stunned, but supportive. This whole thing has escalated so quickly in the past few days. First, you had a ban on media in NBA locker rooms, then the possibility of not letting fans watch games in person. Mm-hmm. And some players were skeptical of these moves as they went along. Some even joked about coronavirus concerns. Rudy Gobert, in fact, finished a news conference earlier this week by touching all the reporters' microphones. He thought it was in jest before leaving the room. And now you wonder what those media people are thinking after last night's news.
Wait, Rudy Gobert, the same guy who contracted the coronavirus.
Exactly right.
Wow. So what about March Madness? The Division I tournaments are supposed to start next week. What's going to happen?
Yeah, and it's being hotly debated now what to do. I mean, with last night's NBA news, there's the belief by some that college basketball has to follow that lead and shut it down. The NCAA yesterday already, the other big news, it took the unprecedented step of announcing there'd be no fans at the men's and women's tournaments, in a sense taking the madness out of March Madness. The tournaments are still on right now. This changes by the hour. But if a decision to cancel happened, Rachel, I don't think too many people would be stunned at this point, the way things have happened so quickly.
All right. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
America has one of the highest rates of gun violence in the developed world, and that has led many states to pass stricter firearms laws in recent years. But gun rights groups in more conservative states, take Idaho, for example, are continuing to push lawmakers to go in the opposite direction. Boise State Public Radio's Heath Druzin has more.
In the halls of Idaho's Capitol building, Greg Pruitt is making a Facebook video.
Hey, everybody. Greg Pruitt here, president of the Idaho Second Amendment Alliance.
He posts regular updates each legislative session for supporters of his influential gun rights group.
We fight hard. We play for keeps. Okay, we take no prisoners.
There's been a lot of talk about guns from national politicians, but little action. The real fight is playing out at the state level. Pruitt's group, for example, has pushed Idaho to get rid of nearly all its regulations. And now lawmakers are poised to drop restrictions on out-of-state residents' right to carry concealed weapons. That proposal sailed through the Idaho House and will likely pass the Senate. Pruitt says he long ago stopped waiting for Washington to act.
The Republicans really didn't do gun owners any favor in the first 2 years of President Trump's tenure when they had the full control of the House and the Senate and obviously the White House.
Idaho has long been gun-friendly, but the state's absolutist turn is more recent. So-called no-compromise gun groups like Pruitt's have been pushing conservative states farther to the right on firearms. Wyoming dropped its permit requirement for concealed weapons. Texas passed a law last year allowing guns in places of worship, and many more bills are in the works. Back in Idaho, the climate has gotten to the point where onlookers barely reacted when an older man and a young girl stepped to the podium to testify in a legislative committee hearing, and the man said,
"My name is Charles Nielsen. This is my granddaughter, Bailey. Bailey is 11 years old. Bailey is carrying a loaded AR-15.
UCLA law professor Adam Winkler wrote the book Gunfight about America's legal battles over firearms.
If one wanted to figure out how successful the gun rights movement has been, you wouldn't look to Congress. You would look to the states.
And this is happening as the trend is going in the opposite direction in much of the country. Idaho's neighbor Nevada enacted sweeping firearms legislation last year. And just last month, New Mexico lawmakers passed a so-called red flag law, meaning courts can temporarily remove guns from at-risk people. Winkler says state gun groups are trying to fight that tide in the absence of federal legislation.
I think the gun rights groups do have a larger strategy that explains things like what's happening in Idaho. The idea is to keep the momentum alive for lifting the restrictions on guns in America.
Also telling is what hasn't passed in Idaho. Bills to keep guns away from certain sex offenders and domestic abusers both failed in the past 2 years. Boise Democrat Melissa Wintrow brought these bills. She was shocked at the outcome. This session, she's not even trying. Confident Republicans won't touch gun laws in an election year.
I've seen some really good representatives that have lost elections because they haven't made the emotional vote that some of those special interest groups want.
Wintrow says some Republicans who voted no on her bills privately told her they support her efforts.
Why can't we have a more balanced discussion? Why can't we talk about public safety? Why can't we talk about the facts and put some of the emotion aside?
The day we talked, Wintrow said gun lobbyists had killed yet another of her bills, this one to extend protections for sexual assault survivors. For NPR News, I'm Heath Druzin.
This is NPR News.
This is WBUR. Coming up on Morning Edition, a closer look at President Trump's coronavirus economic measures. The forecast, we start to break from the sun today. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
We'll see a lot of clouds today, within a couple of degrees of 50 this afternoon, a wind off the water, so coolest there. For tonight, a couple of showers late at night, mostly cloudy, upper 30s to near 40. Showers a good deal of the morning on Friday, maybe a late day shower. Temperatures are warming up towards 60 to 65. As we head for Saturday, sunshine near 50, into the 40s on Sunday with sunny skies and cooler Monday.
In Boston now, 36 degrees. Subscribe to the WBUR Today newsletter to get Dave's forecast every weekday in your inbox.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Virgin Atlantic. Over 300 hours of onboard entertainment, flatbeds for napping, and afternoon tea. Daily nonstop flights to the UK in partnership with Delta Airlines. Bona, maker of Bona hardwood floor cleaner, designed to lift and remove dirt and grime to reveal a floor's natural beauty with water-based solutions. Learn more at bona.com/bonaclean. And Whole Foods Market, with a commitment to offering sustainable, wild-caught, or responsibly farmed seafood to minimize the impact on the environment. Learn more at WholeFoodsMarket.com.
In business news, Bain Capital is closing its Boston headquarters after an employee started showing symptoms of coronavirus. The company says the employee has not yet been tested, but a doctor confirmed the person has symptoms of COVID-19. About 700 people work in the Bain office in Boston, which is now closed indefinitely. The murder mystery comedy show Sheer Madness is closing this weekend after a 40-year run at the Charles Playhouse in Boston. A spokesperson tells the Boston Globe producers decided to close because they believe staying on would lose money, but did not say if closing was driven due to existing problems or fears of coronavirus. Sheer Madness will continue being performed in Washington, D.C. and abroad. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Plymouth Rock Assurance, offering customers a ride home through their Get Home Safe program. Learn more at PlymouthRock.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green in Culver City, California.
And I'm Rachel Martin in Washington, D.C. The World Health Organization has now declared the coronavirus to be a global pandemic. After initially downplaying the threat posed by COVID-19, President Trump announced a number of new measures last night to address the outbreak, including a limited ban on travel from European countries to the United States, which will last for 30 days. The president also promised emergency aid to workers and small businesses.
I will soon be taking emergency action, which is unprecedented, to provide financial relief. This will be targeted for workers who are ill, quarantined, or caring for others due to coronavirus.
So what exactly is that financial relief going to look like? Let's ask NPR's chief economic correspondent, Scott Horsley. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Rachel.
Tell us more about the economic measures introduced by the president last night.
Well, we don't know exactly what that aid is going to look like, but you heard the president there talking about emergency action to help workers who don't have sick leave. The idea is to make up for that lost pay if they're forced to stay home. And the president says he'll act on an emergency basis on his own, and then he's asking Congress for help to extend that relief. He's also instructing the Small Business Administration to offer more low-cost loans to businesses affected by the outbreak, much as the SBA would do in the case of a natural disaster. And again, he's asking Congress for more money, $50 billion more, to expand that assistance. He suggested that the April 15th tax filing deadline could be postponed to give affected workers and businesses more time and also just to keep more money out there flowing around the economy. And he renewed his call for a payroll tax cut.
So I missed the address last night, as I'm sure many other Americans didn't get a chance to watch it. So can you just give us a sense of the president's tone? I mean, was there enough certainty in this address last night to ease concerns of Americans who are concerned about their livelihoods because of the outbreak?
There wasn't a lot of certainty. This is still more of an outline than an actual plan. If the idea was meant to reassure financial markets, it had the opposite effect. The futures market is indicating another big drop in U.S. stocks today. It does look as if both Congress and the administration are now taking the economic threat posed by the coronavirus outbreak seriously, but they don't yet have a coordinated plan to address it. And at the same time, some of the additional public health measures that are being adopted around the country, you know, all the increases in school closings, the work from home orders, things as dramatic as the NBA suspending its sentence, all of that means more economic disruption. It may very well be the right move to take for a public health from a public health standpoint to slow the spread of the virus, but it does come with a short-term economic price tag.
You alluded to some of them, but what are some of the biggest outstanding questions when it comes to the administration's response?
Well, the biggest question is, can they get it together and can they do it quickly? You know, House Democrats appear to be moving on one track, the White House on another. The president continued to press last night for a payroll tax cut. There seems to be very little appetite on Capitol Hill for that. Certainly Democrats don't like the idea, and Republicans aren't very keen on it either. Yeah. There likely will be some agreement on other measures like those small business loans. And they certainly, both lawmakers and the White House, certainly share the goal of helping workers who don't have sick leave and are forced to stay home because of the outbreak, although it's not clear that they're on the same page when it comes to how to accomplish that.
Could we just finally turn to that travel ban? The president limiting travel, banning travel from foreign nationals from Europe to the United States, exempting American citizens trying to get back home if they go through extra screening. But what would be the impact? What could be the impact on international trade?
Well, when it comes to trade in goods, we should say it has no effect. The president's speech was a little bit garbled, and some people were left with the impression that exports from Europe might be affected. The White House clarified in a tweet that the travel ban taking effect at midnight Friday applies only to visitors from Europe, not cargo. But it's still another big blow for the tourist industry. Europeans account for about 30% of international visitors at this time of year, so it's going to be another hit for airlines, hotels, tourist attractions, and the notion of international commerce.
All right, NPR's chief economic correspondent, Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome, Rachel.
The Huntington has underwritten on WBUR for a long time.
Temple Gill, Director of Public Affairs and Strategic Partnerships at the Huntington Theater Company, a WBUR underwriter.
Our audiences have a lot in common. Both are very smart, engaged with the world, and love the arts. And we're very able to track how people respond. It's been a really great match for us.
To become a WBUR underwriter, call 617-353-8451.
This is 90.9 WBUR, coming up on Morning Edition with more colleges in the Boston area and across the nation moving to online classes during the coronavirus outbreak, a look at what's lost when students and professors can't have that in-person classroom contact. Forecast, little sun today, but a lot of clouds. Temperatures get to the upper 40s today. Showers tonight, more showers tomorrow. Tonight, close to 40 degrees. Tomorrow, it'll be mild in the upper 50s. Sunshine for the weekend, sunny in 50s Saturday, sunny in the 40s Sunday. In Boston now, 36 degrees. The time is 7:53.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Office of the Massachusetts State Treasurer. Check to see if you have unclaimed money at findmassmoney.com. And Hebrew Senior Life, empowering seniors to reach their full potential through senior living, health care, aging research, and more. Learn more at allweareforyou.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Ohio State, Harvard, and Duke, just some of the more than 100 universities across the country that have canceled in-person classes because of the coronavirus and then moved those classes online. Some colleges are telling students to just pack up and go home. That's not the case at all schools, though. Paige Flager of member station WOSU in Ohio reports.
Every day for the past week, colleges and universities around the country have made the announcement. In-person classes are canceled due to fears over the spreading coronavirus. Lecture halls will be empty. Labs closed. Concerts canceled. Sports practices called off. All classes will move online. Some universities are asking students to go home early for spring break, and if on break now, not to return to campus at all. A massive shift like this is unprecedented in higher education. It's led to an onslaught of questions for online learning specialists like Karen Costa.
I think like many folks, there's been a lot of shock and stress on a personal and professional level. My first instinct after that initial shock was, how can we get our students and faculty the support that they need to navigate this crisis?
Costa has been fielding questions on Twitter, giving webinars online, uploading YouTube tutorials, all in hopes of easing this transition, which she admits is less than ideal.
To ask somebody to go from a land-based course to an online course without any previous online teaching experience is a huge ask, and it's not something that can be done overnight, and we're trying to do it overnight.
She's spoken with professors who don't have staff or online systems in place to support this shift. And she worries about the digital divide. If students aren't allowed back on campus, some may not have access to reliable internet. As a result, students might drop out. And online learning isn't for everyone. Ohio State senior Cartier Pitt says if she wanted to go to an online university, she would have enrolled in one.
I'm worried about classes being canceled physically because me and virtual online learning like does not get along. Like, I don't like learning online, so it's going to be a rough 2 weeks.
And much longer than 2 weeks for some schools. Pitts worries these changes could keep her from graduating on time. And the move has raised other critical questions about campus life. Just how safe is it to have students on campus at all?
It's worth first thinking about people of college age. They are not at great risk of getting severely ill with the virus that causes COVID-19, but they can act as tremendous amplifiers of the epidemic. And the behaviors that young people have in college, spending a lot of time close together, intimate contact, sharing food and drink, make the spread of viruses in that setting pretty high likelihood.
Andrew Pavia is the chief of pediatric infectious diseases at the University of Utah. He says spaces like dormitories and cafeterias are indeed high-risk environments, but because of the population living there, they're not as risky as, say, a cruise ship.
Big difference with cruise ships is that they tend to have a lot of very vulnerable people. The population on cruise ships tends to be older and sicker. So you don't have that problem in college dorms, but it is a concrete living setting where it's a lot harder to do good infection control.
But Pavia says evicting students from their dorms altogether carries its own set of risks. Some of the students may not have anywhere else to go. For NPR News, I'm Paige Flager in Columbus.
This is NPR News.
This is WBUR. Forecast, couple of days of clouds, mostly cloudy today. There might be a little sunshine, but it's going to balance out on the cloudy side. Highs today in the upper 40s, tonight lows around 40. Tomorrow, clouds and showers. High temperatures, though, a little warmer in the upper 50s on Friday. Sun returns for the weekend, partly sunny around 50 Saturday, sunny in the low 40s Sunday. In Boston right now, outside our studios, it's 36 degrees. Stay with us. The morning's top stories are coming up. The time is 7:59.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the law firm of Hinckley Allen, combining legal strategy with efficiency to address your legal needs with offices in Boston and throughout the Northeast. Online at hinckleyallen.com.
I'm Tiziana Dearing. Today on Radio Boston, we'll take your coronavirus questions and talk about lessons from the 1918 flu outbreak in Boston.
Just as this terribly contagious infection starts to circulate, life goes on almost as normal to the detriment of everybody's health.
That's Radio Boston today at 3, only on 90.9 WBUR.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org.
And when you ask for your smart speaker to play WBUR,
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
The European Union expresses concern about the economic impact of President Trump's move to restrict travel from Europe to the U.S. in the coronavirus outbreak. It's Thursday, March 12th. This is Morning Edition. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Coming up, fallout from the president's move. The European markets are down again this morning, and U.S. stock futures point sharply lower, down around 5% for today. Also this hour, the new phase in the U.S. in the coronavirus fight, more drastic measures.
As a nation, we can't be doing the kinds of things we were doing a few months ago.
And this hour, local public health officials on coronavirus super spreaders, infected people who can infect dozens of others.
Some people end up having a very high viral load, and then they shed a lot more virus than other people.
Forecast, mostly cloudy day today, highs in the 40s. It's 8:01. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump is temporarily banning travelers from most of Europe from entering the United States because of the coronavirus. That does not include Americans or U.S. legal residents, and the United Kingdom is exempt from the ban. In an Oval Office address on Wednesday night, President Trump explained his reasons.
The European Union failed to take the same precautions and restrict travel from China and other hotspots. As a result, a large number of new clusters in the United States were seeded by travelers from Europe.
The ban will last for 30 days. European Union officials are furious, saying the coronavirus is a global threat that is not limited to any continent, and fighting it requires cooperation. In China, where the outbreak originated, officials say the number of new coronavirus infections is lower. There are more than 1,300 cases in the United States, and at least 38 people have died. Oregon health officials say they have uncovered 2 new cases of COVID-19. As Oregon Public Broadcasting's Donald Orr reports, the patients both live at a home for elderly veterans.
Oregon health officials say 2 men in their 80s tested positive. They're now in isolated rooms at the Oregon Veterans Home in Lebanon, a facility with nearly 150 other veterans. Nearly all the residents are over 60, meaning they're at a particularly high risk from COVID-19. The facility is no longer allowing visitors. Residents and staff are being tested for coronavirus. Kelly Fitzpatrick directs Oregon's Veteran Affairs Department.
We understand how important it is for family members to communicate with their loved ones in this critical time, but we are asking for their help in keeping our residents safe.
The Northwest has already had a severe outbreak at a center with older adults. More than 20 deaths in Washington are linked to coronavirus at a nursing home in Kirkland. For NPR News, I'm Donald Orr in Portland.
The Senate has voted to overturn a rule instituted by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. This is her rewrite of a rule known as borrower defense. NPR's Corey Turner reports it was used under the Obama administration to help those who had been defrauded by for-profit colleges.
The rule originally allowed the Ed Department to erase borrowers' federal student loans if their schools had lied about things like the transfer of credits or job prospects after graduation. But DeVos called this approach free money and had the rule changed. Under the revised rule, borrowers would have to meet a tougher standard to prove they had been intentionally misled. It also required students to prove they'd been hurt financially. 10 Republicans crossed the aisle to block the change from taking effect. It's not clear if President Trump will use his veto power to back DeVos. In a statement, the Ed Department called the bipartisan vote disappointing. Corey Turner, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WQBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. More now on the coronavirus outbreak. Members of the state's all-Democratic congressional delegation are questioning the usefulness of President Trump's temporary ban on travel from Europe because of coronavirus. Congressman Jim McGovern says the focus should be on providing more tests for the virus here in the U.S. Senator Ed Markey would rather see the president declare a federal emergency so that states can get federal funds to fight the disease.
We have seen a dangerous, complete abdication of leadership from Donald Trump. His mismanagement of this crisis is unconscionable. It is immoral. And the harm that it is causing the American people is an injustice.
Markey says an emergency declaration would free up $42 billion for coronavirus efforts. Massport says it's evaluating what President Trump's travel restrictions from Europe mean for Logan Airport. The ban does not apply to U.S. citizens, but many local colleges are still telling students studying abroad to come home early. Leah Mason is a Northeastern University student from Medfield studying abroad in Spain. She says she was told to come home yesterday, and she's at the airport in Barcelona this morning.
It's pretty hectic. Checking in took me about an hour and a half to almost 2 hours just to check my two bags. Security was also pretty long, but it wasn't as long as check-in. But everyone's pretty stressed out.
More colleges and universities are moving their instruction online because of the outbreak. The New England Conservatory says it'll switch to online teaching after spring break, which is now being extended by 2 weeks. Williams College is dismissing students 1 week early for spring break and will start online teaching in April, and Brandeis says all classes will move online by the end of the month. Some local schools are closing because of the virus. All Framingham public schools are closed today for cleaning after a parent of an elementary school student tested positive. Somerville schools are closed until next week for cleaning as well, and three campuses of Boston's Elliott School are closed through next week because a school community member also has the virus. Supply chains for U.S. businesses are being squeezed in the outbreak, and according to an MIT professor, things are likely to get worse before they get better. More from WBUR's Adrian Ma.
As people start staying in and working from home, that means less money spent on everything from restaurants to iPhones. And as retailers and suppliers start cutting back,
this will be like 2008, 2009. There will be a worldwide recession.
Yossi Sheffi is director of MIT's Center for Transportation and Logistics. He predicts small suppliers and manufacturers will feel the most pain.
Just like families are living paycheck to paycheck, many of these small companies are living order to order, and they will start failing.
But he says at least one service is likely to stay busy, food delivery. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Adrian Ma.
Stay with WBUR through the day today for the latest developments on coronavirus. You can get the latest at our website, WBUR.org, and sign up for our email alerts about coronavirus stories. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Applied Biomath, applying mechanistic mathematical modeling, simulation, and analysis to accelerate and de-risk drug R&D. More at AppliedBiomath.com. Harvard Pilgrim. When you get Harvard Pilgrim, you get a health plan that guides you on your personal path to well-being. See how at harvardpilgrim.org. And Capital One, offering a variety of credit card options with features for a range of customers, from foodies to travelers. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USA, N.A.
Sports, the Celtics game planned for tonight in Milwaukee has been canceled, along with the rest of the NBA season for now. The league suspended all play last night after a Utah Jazz player tested positive for coronavirus. Forecast, more clouds than sun today. It'll get to the upper 40s. Cloudy tonight with a few showers, lows around 40. A wet Friday, showers, and in the upper 50s. Sunny for Saturday and for Sunday. On Saturday, close to 50 degrees. On Sunday, closer to 40. In Boston now, 36 degrees, 33 degrees in Watertown right now, 34 in Newburyport, and 33 in Brockton at 8:08.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green in Culver City, California.
And I'm Rachel Martin in Washington, D.C. The coronavirus is a pandemic.
That's the conclusion of the World Health Organization. Infections are on the rise in many countries, and that is triggering more global disruptions. Last night, President Trump announced a 30-day ban on foreign nationals traveling to the United States from most countries in Europe. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein joins us now to help us understand the latest developments. Hi, Rob.
Hey there, Rachel.
Let's start with the president's travel ban. Is this going to reduce the spread of coronavirus?
You know, Rachel, most public health experts I've talked to say, look, the virus is already here, so banning Europeans is unlikely to do much good. And it actually could make things worse, you know, by diverting resources from what's really needed, which is stopping the spread here. That's got to be the top priority right now.
All right. What about the WHO now calling the coronavirus a pandemic? What are the implications of that?
You know, it shows how worried the WHO is that things are getting worse. The WHO had hesitated to use the word pandemic. They were worried that it might make things seem hopeless. So officials are really stressing that there's still lots that can be done to fight this virus.
All right. So what's the latest with that fight in this country?
You know, there's still a lot of frustration with the federal response, especially about testing. But the government has started giving cities and counties fighting outbreaks specific advice about what to do. You know, recommending things like telework and protecting nursing homes and canceling large gatherings. And that's really where things are heading. There's a big shift in strategy going on right now towards what experts call mitigation, which is actually basically keeping people apart to try to slow the spread of the virus. That's what will save lives. You know, to try to get a sense of the shift in the nation's strategy, let's just listen to Anthony Fauci from the White House Coronavirus Task Force.
As a nation, we can't be doing the kinds of things we were doing a few months ago.
When the coronavirus first hit the U.S., disease detectives swooped in to try to stop the germ from spreading, isolating sick people, tracking down and quarantining everyone they had contact with to try to contain the virus, to stop it from spreading. But increasingly across the nation, experts worry that's not enough anymore.
It's clearly too late to contain it in much of the country.
Mark Lipsitch is a Harvard epidemiologist. He says the long delay in testing let the virus get a foothold in this country, so it's probably already spread much more than we realize, and that's likely to accelerate in the coming weeks.
It's unsustainable in an exponentially growing epidemic to keep increasing the efforts to trace individual cases.
Because understaffed and underfunded public health departments are getting overwhelmed trying to track down and monitor everyone. So while testing is still really important, public health experts are increasingly also calling for what's called mitigation to slow the spread of the virus. Get people to work from home, close schools, cancel big events.
I'm extremely worried that we are just letting transmission continue by sitting and sort of living business as usual. We are just wasting time as the epidemic grows. Time to act is now.
Because if too many places wait too long, it will be too late. Here's Anthony Fauci again testifying before Congress.
It's the old metaphor that the Wayne Gretzky approach. You know, you skate not to where the puck is, but to where the puck is going to be. If we don't do very serious mitigation now, what's going to happen is that we're going to be weeks behind and the horse is going to be out of the barn.
So more and more communities are shifting their tactics. Sacramento County stopped quarantining everyone who had contact with someone who was infected. Instead, Peter Bielenson says people should monitor themselves and vulnerable people, like the elderly, should minimize their exposure.
So, for example, avoiding malls. If they have to go to a grocery store, go off hours and buy 2 or 3 weeks of groceries at a time so they don't have to go back and expose themselves.
Jeffrey Engel of the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists says there's probably no one-size-fits-all strategy. Sacramento is going ahead with its St. Patrick's Day parade, while other cities have put off theirs.
It's happening community by community, so I think we're going to see this patchwork approach across the United States.
Other experts agree that makes sense. Thomas Inglesby heads the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security.
It's not black or white. I think that there are places where we can potentially identify a chain of transmission and isolate that group and try to stop the chain of transmission in that place. But I think there are other parts of the country or other cases where that's not going to be possible. I don't think we should give up on the former, but we just have to acknowledge the latter.
So, you know, Rachel, it's clear that we've got to get ready for a lot more disruptions in our daily lives, unfortunately.
Right. Thanks so much, Rob. NPR's Rob Stein.
The Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking scandal did not end with his death. The story keeps evolving, and we're going to hear now how one newspaper came to question the ethics of one of America's most powerful lawyers. Relying on an informant who later disappeared, the New York Times launched an investigation into attorney David Boies, who represents some of Epstein's alleged victims. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik looks at the story behind the story.
Initially, everyone was hungry for material about Epstein. After all, Epstein had ties to so many powerful men. The informant went by the pseudonym Patrick Kessler. He claimed he had been an IT consultant for Epstein.
He also claimed to have not just videos, but all sorts of electronic communications and bank records and things like that.
David Enrich is the business investigative editor for the New York Times.
That provide this supposedly unvarnished, very detailed inside look inside of Jeffrey Epstein's life and finances.
Kessler provided tantalizing allegations about Epstein's famous friends when he met with reporters for the first time at David Boies' office. An hour later, the story would completely change. Kessler texted a Times reporter separately. They met in the back of a Chinese restaurant later that afternoon. Here, reporters Emily Steele and Jake Bernstein on the Times TV show The Weekly.
But then he told us something else, and this was about the lawyers.
He said, "What do you think of David Boies?"
New York Times investigative reporter Jessica Silver Greenberg was part of the team. She had been thinking hard about the lawyers circling the Epstein scandal.
We were intensely interested in the universe of people, powerful men, that had potentially enabled Epstein and allowed him to continue to allegedly abuse women for decades.
Silver Greenberg tells NPR that some lawyers representing Epstein's accusers were enablers, too. Boies was prominent among the lawyers for Epstein's alleged victims, and Silver Greenberg says he was already on her radar. The Times had big ambitions and high hopes for the story. Again, Emily Steele on the Times TV show.
If true, this not only could crack open the Epstein story, but it also might expose how two of America's most prominent lawyers were talking about plans that would keep evidence of abuse secret.
The two lawyers they focused on were David Boies and his friend Stan Pottinger. Pottinger exchanged text messages with Kessler, the supposed informant. In those texts, published by the Times, Pottinger tells Kessler lawyers could get the friends of Epstein, who are supposedly on the videos, to pay big settlements. Accusations of sexual misconduct could be kept secret, and the lawyers could get hefty payouts. On the Times TV show, Enrich presses Boies about the texts.
Listen, we're trying to understand if there's a way to interpret this other than the way that it looks to us.
And what I'm saying is that these aren't my text messages, okay?
Boies says he had no idea what Pottinger was telling Kessler. And Rich tells me he thinks that's true, that Boies had no idea what was in the texts.
He was visibly surprised to see them, and I think visibly upset to see them. He says that he did not intend to do what Stan Pottinger said they were discussing doing. And I think I can give him the benefit of the doubt on that.
Pottinger told the Times even those hypothetical scenarios were made up. He told the paper he was trying to get Kessler to share his material and that he informed the FBI of Kessler's claims. None of this stopped the New York Times from doing the story or from focusing it largely on Boies. It ultimately devoted 5,400 words in an hour-long TV show to its exposé. The reporters relied on Kessler, the informant, to generate a tale of deceit, greed, and complicity, even though they concluded Kessler was a liar and though they failed to connect Boies directly to wrongdoing.
What I think is not fair journalism is to somehow imply I was involved in what was being discussed when the Times knows and has acknowledged that I didn't even know about those text messages until they showed them to me.
NPR sought comment from Pottinger four times without success. David Boies tells NPR the Times wrongly folds him into suggestions of blackmail and fraud.
And while it is true that the Times doesn't explicitly say I was deceitful, for them to put that in the article that is about me without making clear that they're not making that allegation about me is, I think, quite misleading.
The Times reporters concede they have no evidence Boies sought to profit. Now they tell me that doesn't matter. They say their story shows what plaintiffs' lawyers are doing when they think no one is looking. And let's pause to acknowledge why the Times found Boies newsworthy. Again, Emily Steele and David Enrich of the Times on the TV show The Weekly.
For a while, he was kind of lauded as the modern-day Atticus Finch.
Litigating some of the country's most famous cases, whether it's Bush v. Gore or the Microsoft antitrust case or gay marriage before the Supreme Court.
David Boies is a legal legend, but a damaged one, thanks to his involvement in a pair of scandals. First, the fraudulent blood testing company Theranos, where Boies served both as an outside lawyer and a corporate director. Second, Boies was a lawyer for the disgraced producer Harvey Weinstein. He hired ex-spies for Weinstein, who monitored and misled reporters for The Times. Those scandals fueled The Times' interest in Boies. And what of Kessler? Who is he? A scam artist? An extortionist? A plant designed to discredit the lawyers? The Times journalists say they tried in vain to figure out who he was, but never thought to hold off until they did. Despite that question mark, they wouldn't let the story go, even though their chief source turned out to be, in their own words, a liar. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Ahead on Morning Edition, concerns of Massachusetts nurses in caring for coronavirus patients and how, in some cases, the nurses are being told to reuse the masks that they wear. And we hear about some infected people who are super infectious. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Staples, with printers, printer ink, and toner cartridges for home and business, and in-store print shops for customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. More at Staples stores. Staples. From Autism Speaks, their goal is to make 2020 the year of kindness for people with autism and their families through 1 million acts of kindness, big and small. More at autismspeaks.org/kindness. And T. Rowe Price, offering a strategic investing approach that examines investment opportunities firsthand. Institutions, advisors, employers, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence.
Now the forecast. Less sun today than we've had in the last few. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
We'll see a lot of clouds for your Thursday. Temperatures will be approaching 50. Now the wind off the water keeps it coolest right at the coast. Tonight a couple of showers around. Lots of clouds, 38 to 43. On Friday, showers, especially the first half of the day. Temperatures upper 50s to mid-60s, warmest southwest of Austin. On Saturday, it's a nice day. We're near 50, plenty of sunshine, a little breezy. Sunday, mostly sunny, mid-40s, and Monday is cool, 40 to 45.
In Boston now, 37 degrees at 8:22.
Funding for WBUR weather reports comes from GEICO, offering the GEICO mobile app, which stores ID cards and enables bill pay and claim reports directly from your cell phone. Learn more at geico.com. Other supporters include Mass Eye and Ear, specializing in treating and curing eye cancers so you can live life to the fullest. MassEyeAndEar.org/eyecancers.
You are being watched all the time from space by a spy agency that most of you have never heard of.
Most people understand that some of their information is being monitored, and we just have to recognize that there's an ability to observe more from space than ever before.
That, plus the latest on the coronavirus outbreak, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on 90.9, and when you ask your smart speaker to play WBUR.
This is WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. Hundreds of Massachusetts residents are sheltering themselves due to fears about the coronavirus outbreak, which the World Health Organization has now declared a pandemic. But nurses and other medical professionals throughout the Commonwealth continue to treat patients during the outbreak, putting themselves at risk of contracting the virus. Christine Pontus is Associate Director of Health and Safety with the Massachusetts Nurses Association, and she joins us now to talk about the precautions nurses are taking against coronavirus. Hi, Christine. Thanks for speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition.
And thank you for having me talk to you.
Let's start this way. What are you hearing from nurses throughout the state? What concerns are they bringing up?
Well, the nurses who are voicing a concern, of course, wondering if there will be enough personal protective equipment while they're actually taking care of someone who is positive for the virus. their concern is, okay, if they're asked to reuse now in some of the facilities, what will happen when the hospitals start to load up with more virus-positive patients?
So are some nurses being asked to reuse the garments and the gear that they dress up in as a precaution to take care of patients?
Yes, not so much the garments. The gloves and the aprons, you know, they're able to dispose of them. It's specifically the N95 masks in the CDC's interim guidance that just came out that there's a reuse clause. You know, we're asking the nurses to reuse their N95s. The nurses want to be able to dispose of it in the room and come out of the room without the mask. But if they're using it from room to room because they're waiting for a positive test to come, for example, that's, the protocol isn't there. It's not established, and that's the concern.
Do you know of any nurses who now have presumptive cases because they've been exposed to patients who have cases?
No. Presumptive cases, no. We know of nurses who are sent home, which is very good practice on behalf of the hospital. You know, and nurses are pretty keen people. They know they need to take care of themselves to come back and take care of their patients also.
What precautions have hospitals taken to protect nurses as the outbreak has unfolded?
Well, the hospital is responding appropriately, as many of them are, is the resources they have. Some are very progressive. They have tents outside screening people. Some have anti-rooms. So this is part of the dilemma, is that not every hospital is equal in resources, the way it's configured, you know, physically, the number of staff. So there's a lot of variables. So the message here is that we as a scientific community, along with the public health epidemiologists and doctors, we want to be reasonable as an organization of nurses to respond appropriately.
Do the nurses feel, do you feel that the hospitals and the healthcare system has done enough to protect nurses so far?
So it's a very fluid situation. Some of our nurses in some of the hospitals in Massachusetts are saying they're fine. They've got enough equipment. And then there's others that are showing some concern because, for example, a patient proved positive and they had to send nurses home and they're being asked to reuse. So we're hoping that the interim guidance from CDC and the extra equipment that's coming in will help to alleviate any concerns and to keep the virus at bay by educating people to stay home who are symptomatic, social distancing, and practice good hygiene.
Christine Pontus, Associate Director of Health and Safety with the Massachusetts Nurses Association. Thanks very much for speaking with WBUR.
Thank you very much.
As state officials have shared Massachusetts coronavirus numbers, one has been especially striking. 77 of the state's 95 confirmed or presumptive cases stemmed from a meeting held by the biotech company Biogen in late February. Public health researchers call clusters like this super-spreading events, where an individual infects an unusually high number of other people. WBUR's Kerry Goldberg explains.
Everyone's heard of Typhoid Mary, the New York cook who's believed to have spread typhoid fever in the early 20th century. She used to be seen as an anomaly because doctors thought everyone spread an infection about equally. Now it's known that so-called super spreaders are common in epidemics, including SARS in 2003 and a 2011 measles outbreak in Canada. Yale professor Nicholas Christakis says a super spreader apparently sparked the current coronavirus outbreak in Italy.
We know from genetic analyses in Italy that the epidemic there was started, we think, by two people, one of whom gave it to 43 other people.
Christakis is a physician and sociologist who studies social networks.
The question arises when we see a super spreading episode like this episode at Biogen appears to be, what's the cause of it? Is it just chance? Or is it something to do with the particular circumstances?
Though super spreading has been documented in several epidemics, it's not well understood, says Dr. Ashish Jha. He's a professor of health policy at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health.
We certainly think biology plays a role. Some people end up having a very high viral load, and then they shed a lot more virus than other people. It may be something to do with their immune system, something to do with how that immune system is reacting to the virus.
Initial findings suggest the coronavirus could be quite contagious early on, possibly even before the spreader knows they're sick. Nicholas Christakis from Yale says other factors could cause people to become super spreaders, like a propensity to cough.
You know, maybe they have a lung disease, for example, and so they're doing more coughing anyway. And so compared to a person who doesn't cough, they transmit it more.
The environment can encourage spreading too. Poor ventilation, overcrowding, or Christakis says maybe a super spreader is just more gregarious.
So there are many types of situations or circumstances that can contribute to the phenomenon of super spreading. And it's not always possible to know, or typically is not possible to know in advance, who or under what circumstances we're going to get a super spreading event.
So that's part of why large gatherings are a bad idea right now, Harvard's Ashish Jha says. Because if you have a super spreader in a crowd,
it can really make things explode. And the name of the game right now for America is a slow and steady rise in infections. We've got to stop kind of explosive growth, because that's what's going to cripple our health system and really harm people. And super spreaders can end up being an important part of that problem if we get them into large groups.
In retrospect, Jha says, Biogen probably should have canceled its meeting. But decisions are easier in retrospect. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
Coming up on Morning Edition, in the worldwide effort to fight coronavirus, what strategies have actually worked in other countries? Get your daily dose of health news at WBUR's Common Health blog. Today, learn how the coronavirus is affecting the supply of prescription drugs to the U.S. That's the Common Health blog today at WBUR.org, and join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Common Health.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by WellPath, 8,000 doctors and medical specialists providing health care in jails, hospitals, and treatment centers, committed to bringing hope and healing to those who need it most. The BSO, Andre Raphael leads music by Coleridge Taylor, Still, and Yuri Kane's The Passion of Octavius Caddo, March 19th to 21st, BSO.org. And Sunbug Solar, a certified B Corporation, offering full-service solar system design and installation. Learn what the sun can do for you at sunbugsolar.com.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump is imposing a 30-day travel ban on most Europeans entering the U.S. because of the coronavirus. This follows the World Health Organization declaring the COVID-19 outbreak to be a global pandemic. The travel ban does not apply to Americans, legal permanent residents, or their family members. Here's Vice President Pence this morning on Fox News.
The risk to the average American of contracting the coronavirus remains low, but we do know that seniors with serious underlying chronic health conditions are particularly vulnerable to very serious outcomes.
The virus is blamed for at least 38 deaths in the U.S., the majority at a nursing home in the Seattle area. The NBA is suspending the rest of its season because of the virus. NPR's Tom Goldman says a player on the Utah Jazz tested positive.
Utah All-Star center Rudy Gobert had been sick, and as a precaution, he was tested for COVID-19. That came back positive. And even though he could play last night, he said he thought he could play last night before Utah's game against Oklahoma City in Oklahoma City. The game instead was called off right before the opening tip, right after his test result came back.
The NCAA says its upcoming Division I March Madness basketball tournament will be played without fans as a precaution. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. More now on the local impact of the coronavirus. The State Department of Health is now reporting 95 cases of COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. Brandeis, Williams, Boston College, and the New England Conservatory are the latest colleges to announce they're moving classes online. UMass Amherst is sending students home. Some students say they understand the public health reasons, but are disappointed. Taylor Cassidy is a UMass Amherst senior.
So unfortunately, I'll be pretty negatively impacted by moving to distance learning because so much of my material is still in physical form and requires like going to the library.
Public schools are closed today in Framingham and Somerville, along with three campuses of the Elliott School in Boston. In Dorchester, the Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the U.S. Senate is closing through at least early April because of coronavirus. Officials say the institute will be cleaned. Civic education programs and school visits are also canceled. Next door, the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum is already closed. That after two employees attended a conference last week, attended by others who are now positive for the virus. Organizers of the Boston Marathon say their priority is the health and safety of everyone who takes part in the race. And right now, the race is still on for next month, April 20th. The Boston Athletic Association says it's working with city and state officials to discuss the situation and that more information is coming. Stay with WBUR and NPR through the day today for the latest coronavirus developments and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at WBUR. Sports, the Celtics plan to return from Milwaukee today now that the NBA has suspended play for the season. The league suspended play last night after a player tested positive for coronavirus. That player was from the Utah Jazz. Celtics scheduled to play the Bucks tonight. That game will not happen. Red Sox beat the Rays 3-1 last night in spring training baseball. Sox are off today and play the Rays again tomorrow. Forecast, mostly cloudy today with some sunny breaks. Highs today in the upper 40s. Cloudy tonight. Lows around 40 degrees. Showers tomorrow, off and on through the day. Highs in the upper 50s on Friday. Partly sunny by Saturday. It'll be near 50 Saturday, then sunny in the low 40s on Sunday. In Boston now, 38 degrees, 32 in Worcester, 34 in Lowell, and 32 degrees in Plymouth at 8:35.
Funding for WBUR Weather Reports comes from GEICO, offering the GEICO mobile app, which stores ID cards and enables bill pay and claim reports directly from your cell phone. Learn more at geico.com. Other supporters include CFA Institute. CFA charter holders are wealth managers committed to helping unlock opportunities for their clients' ambitious wealth goals. Learn more at therightquestion.org. And Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, developing ways to use the PD-L1 pathway in immunotherapy to treat cancer. Committed to making contributions in cancer treatment for 72 years. DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green in Culver City, California.
And I'm Rachel Martin in Washington, D.C. After more than a decade of planning, today, households will start to get information about how to participate in the 2020 census. It is a massive effort to count every single person living in this country. It requires expertise, billions of dollars, and trust from the public. The coronavirus, of course, adds another challenge. Hansi Lo Wang is NPR's resident expert on all things census, and he joins us now from New York. Hi, Hansi.
Good morning, Rachel.
Let's start with the coronavirus. What is the Census Bureau doing to protect census workers and the public?
The Census Bureau says it's ready to change its plans depending on the situation. Its outreach workers are holding meetings over the phone rather than in person, and it's prepared to delay sending out census workers later this year in outbreak areas. But the main strategy for now is the Bureau is encouraging every household to fill out a form themselves. Do it from home. No contact with other people needed. You can do it on my2020census.gov, over the phone, or mail back a paper form if you get one.
So let's get to this issue of trust, because it's a big deal for a lot of people worried about their privacy, right? How's the Census Bureau, how does it make sure people's information is protected?
Well, the Census Bureau is required by federal law to keep people's information confidential, specifically information that identifies individuals. That cannot be released by the Census Bureau for 72 years. But of course, the question is, will certain members of the public trust the Trump administration to uphold these laws? There's a history, if going back to World War II, of Congress lifting up similar protections in the name of national security. The government has apologized for this, but that led to the wrongful incarceration of more than 100,000 U.S. citizens of Japanese descent. Another thing to take into account here is this is going to be the first primarily online census. So you have the risk of data getting hacked by someone trying to disrupt the census, any potential foreign actors. And because the census is going online, the Bureau says it is working with the Department of Homeland Security as well as federal intelligence agencies to monitor this very closely. But this will be a very big test.
Right. So what if the public doesn't trust the process, doesn't trust the Census Bureau? What does that mean for the actual count?
This is always a challenge when we're talking about the census. And the thing to keep in mind here is that research shows that self-response, that is people voluntarily giving their information, is the most accurate way to gather data. And what could happen here is that the Bureau could get really bad data if people do not respond, mm-hmm. if people decide that they do not want to take part in this, and the Bureau will have to rely on, for example, existing records to try to fill in the gaps.
And what's the problem with bad data? I mean, what's the purpose of the census in the first place?
This is about distributing congressional seats, electoral college votes among the states, and an estimated $1.5 trillion a year in federal funding for healthcare, schools, and roads. This forms a foundation for how we divide up power and money in the country, and we only do it once every 10 years.
All right, NPR's Hansi Lo Wang. Thanks, Hansi. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, Rachel.
Around the world, of course, governments have been responding to the coronavirus pandemic very differently, we should say. China restricted the movement of hundreds of millions of people. Singapore offered free health care to anyone who might be infected. Both of those countries moved aggressively, in part because of their experience with the deadly SARS outbreak that began in 2002. But other nations have responded far less aggressively. And NPR's Jason Beaubien reports that lessons from abroad do not bode well for the United States.
The World Health Organization's head of emergencies, Mike Ryan, is a veteran of global epidemics, from SARS to bird flu to Ebola. Earlier this week at the WHO's daily press briefing, the burly, straight-talking Irishman practically pleaded with governments to take action against the coronavirus, whether they have large outbreaks yet or not.
As I've said many times in the past, hope is not a strategy. And therefore, when we look at this as being realistic, we're still very much in the up cycle of this epidemic.
What governments do or don't do regarding this virus matters, Ryan said. He pointed out how incredibly aggressive measures by China, South Korea and Japan appear to be bringing those outbreaks under control.
There's clearly an indication that the application of measures across all of society, a systematic government-led approach using all tactics and all elements available, seems to be able to turn this disease around.
Hong Kong and Singapore are two places that got hit early with cases. Both quickly set up systems to identify and treat patients. Hong Kong developed diagnostic tests and rapidly deployed them to labs at every major hospital in the city. At one point in February, Hong Kong had 12,000 people in quarantine. Singapore's prime minister called for calm and assured residents that all health care related to the disease would be free. Both Hong Kong and Singapore continued to find a few new cases each week, but they've avoided the explosive outbreaks that have occurred elsewhere. Each has had fewer than 200 cases, while France, Germany, and Spain have all had 10 times that number. Italy and Iran, where things are really bad right now, have been reporting more than 1,000 new cases some days.
Some countries have been very aggressive and have actually done quite a good job.
Ashish Jha runs the Harvard Global Health Institute.
Other countries have been quite lackadaisical and I think have suffered immensely from it. And I think there are lessons to be learned for all of us.
He says Italy and Iran both appeared to be in denial about the health crisis.
I mean, you know, you had the Iran deputy health minister coughing on national television and talking about coronavirus, but really not taking it seriously.
That deputy health minister later tested positive. As people started to get sick, neither Italy nor Iran was doing much testing. They were slow to stop mass gatherings. And eventually, the health systems in both countries were overwhelmed with cases. So how well has the United States done so far?
Our response is much, much worse than almost any other country that's been affected.
Jha uses the words stunning, fiasco, and mind-blowing to describe the U.S. response.
And I don't understand it. I still don't understand why we don't have extensive testing.
The CDC started screening overseas travelers for coronavirus in mid-January, but it's only this week that wide-scale testing has started to become available. Jha says that delay, at a time when numerous other tests were available around the world, has completely hampered the U.S. response to this crisis.
Without testing, you have no idea how extensive the infection is. You can't isolate people. You can't do anything. And so then we're left with a completely different set of choices, like we have to shut sort of schools and events, everything down, because that's the only tool available to us until we get testing back up. It's been stunning to me how bad the federal response has been.
He says right now there are probably 5 to 10 times as many cases out in U.S. communities as have actually been detected. And until they're found, they're likely to infect more people, and the outbreak in the United States is just going to continue to grow. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR, a head-on morning edition, how the solar industry, which has placed solar panels on the roofs of thousands and thousands of homes across the country, is now targeting renters. Now the weather. A little sun out there right now in Boston, but it's mostly gray today. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
A lot of clouds for your Thursday. I can't rule out a little sun. It's cooler. We're up near 50, a wind off the water. Tonight, mostly cloudy skies. There might be a shower toward morning. Temperatures 38 to 42. On Friday, showers. It warms up later in the day with a southwesterly wind. Those showers could yield a heavier downpour. Not a lot of rain. Temperature 60, maybe even as high as 63. On Saturday, sunshine near 50. Sunday, sunny, mid-40s. Monday, sunny, low to mid-40s.
In Boston now, 40 degrees. Subscribe to the WBUR Today newsletter to get Dave's forecast every weekday in your inbox.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Salem 5 Bank, introducing the Open Account. One checking choice open to everyone. Visit salem5.com/open to learn more.
In business news, Woonsocket, Rhode Island-based CVS is acquiring 110 pharmacies in the Midwest as part of its deal to buy the company Schnucks Pharmacies. CVS says nearly all the Schnucks stores will be rebranded after the deal closes. Financial terms of the deal to acquire Schnucks were not disclosed. The Boston-based biopharma company Imara goes public today. The company hopes to raise $75 million in its initial public offering. Imara is working to develop treatments for rare genetic hemoglobin disorders. This is WBUR. It's 8:46.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, Masters in Mental Health Counseling. Whether you prefer typical academic settings or individualized learning, you'll thrive. No GRE required. Experientially based classes are led by supportive faculty. State licensure eligible. More at bgsp.edu.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Rooftop solar panels have gotten really popular because homeowners can sell any surplus power they generate to their utility company. Now there's a company in Utah which is trying to make that an option for people who rent apartments. Leah Larson with member station KUER in Salt Lake City reports.
Aurora and Seth McCausland and their two kids live in the newly constructed Sole Lofts. They like the apartment's stainless steel appliances, modern tile, and sweeping mountain views. But the main reason they moved here is a sleek white box in the middle of their living room.
We always have people ask us about it whenever they come over. They're always like, what is that? They always think it's like a fridge or something.
Actually, it's a battery. It stores power generated by solar panels on the roof. The batteries are state-of-the-art, which pushes up the rent here by about $150 for a one-bedroom unit. But to Aurora, the clean energy component makes it worth the extra cost.
We love the idea of moving somewhere where it's doing something good for the environment.
Sole Lofts is a pilot project for PacifiCorp, which provides electricity to 6 western states. The company controls the battery inside each apartment. So when the solar panels are generating more energy than their residents need, they can dispatch it elsewhere. The batteries are key because rooftop solar tends to produce energy during the day when demand for electricity is low. Michael Craig, an assistant professor of energy systems at the University of Michigan, says projects like Sole Lofts create a virtual power plant, a network of flexible generators that produce energy locally instead of at a big centralized plant that's far away.
You can take a virtual power plant and operate it as if you would operate a gas plant or a coal plant, for instance, by smoothing the resource out and by shifting some of the resources into periods when you want it most.
Still under construction, the 21-building, 600-apartment Sole Lofts is one of the largest projects of its kind in the West, and one of the first virtual power plant projects built from the ground up.
I think it's significant just because virtual power plants are relatively new, and it's always great to see more and more demonstration of emerging technologies in the field.
PacifiCorp's Bill Como says virtual power plants could be a small part of the company's big plans to take the vast majority of its coal plants offline by 2038, replacing them in part with renewables.
If we had more and more of these types of things, we have all these existing assets, we wouldn't have to build as many renewable plants out there. We wouldn't have to increase our transmission lines.
Taking green technologies you install at home and using them to benefit the community is called being a good grid citizen, says Kate Bauman with the advocacy group Utah Clean Energy.
You can think about how to manage your energy use in a way that isn't just helping you save money on bills or helping you cut your environmental footprint, but actually helps to make the grid as a whole more flexible.
Bauman says the Solely Lofts project could help PacifiCorp provide battery solutions to more of its rooftop solar customers around the West, as home batteries are becoming more affordable. Back in his apartment, Seth McCausland isn't too shy to brag about being a good grid citizen.
I like to bring it up because people will be like, wow, your apartment's really cool. And I was like, yeah, but it's also solar powered.
For NPR News, I'm Leah Larson in Salt Lake City.
Coming up later today on All Things Considered, last year, we found out that an 8-year-old chess champion was homeless. You'll hear how his life has changed dramatically since then. Tell your smart speaker to play NPR, or you can ask for your member station by name. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green.
You are being watched all the time from space by a spy agency that most of you have never heard of.
Most people understand that some of their information is being monitored, and we just have to recognize that there's an ability to observe more from space than ever before.
That, plus the latest on the coronavirus outbreak, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on 90.9, and when you ask your smart speaker to play WBUR.
Coming up on WBUR's Morning Edition, it's Hurt Bernie Sanders' 2020 campaign, how the youth vote has been lagging so far in the presidential primary season. Forecast, we get a mostly cloudy day today with a few sunny breaks every now and then. High temperatures mostly in the upper 40s. Tonight, clouds, low temperatures right down near 40 degrees. Tomorrow, some showers and closer to the upper 50s. For the weekend, sunny skies Saturday and Sunday, 50 on Saturday, then the low 40s on Sunday. In Boston now, 40 degrees.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years. GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. Bernie Sanders' run for president has focused a lot on this.
I think that my campaign kind of speaks to the idealism of young people.
But after struggling recently, he admitted this after Super Tuesday last week.
Have we been as successful as I would hope in bringing young people in? And the answer is no.
And that trend played out again this week. Sanders was hoping Michigan would go his way. It did not. And when you look at the data, youth turnout was down in that state compared to 2016. So what's going on here? Let's ask Maria Teresa Kumar. She's president of the political organization Voto Latino. They have not endorsed candidates in this political season. They have been trying to engage a new generation of Latino voters. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So what should we take from this? Is there a lack of enthusiasm among younger voters?
It's not that there's a lack of enthusiasm. I think that in order for young people to be brought into the political process, especially this early on in a primary, you need to have more than just one candidate speaking to them and to their values. They are incredibly diverse, as you can imagine, as a generation. But at the same time, when candidates start cultivating them, not just Bernie Sanders, but all of them across the board, they start paying attention. And the reason this is unique this time around is that for the very first time, you will have 12 million more young voters than baby boomers in this election. It'll be the first, you know, lopsided young generation versus older generation. And two-thirds of those kids are people of color. Now, of those voters. And the reason I emphasize that is to give you an idea, as of early February, when people were claiming that they were fighting for the hearts and souls of voters and young people, 66% of Latino youth never received a contact from a political candidate or campaign.
Wow, so they were talking about engaging, but not necessarily actually engaging. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, if you say that more than one candidate has to get involved, I mean, that makes me wonder if Joe Biden has work to do. Let's say he secures the nomination, going by the numbers, that's very possible. What does he need to do to win over young voters and get them to turn out in a general election if it's him?
He needs to come out and have them trust him, meet him where they are. Joe Biden is doing an incredible job with baby boomers, with older African-American voters, and that's where the schism is. You look at how he's doing with young African-American voters, and people are warm to him, but they're not driving out in droves. And so in order for this election to be had, people have to be able to close the voter registration gap among those young people. They have to be able to come out and talk to them and meet them where they are. And it's really about the economy and the environment. That's what mobilizes them. And make sure that they are investing. Bernie Sanders didn't do blanketly well among young people, but he did do situationally well, depending on which state. So he focused a lot on Arizona. He focused a lot on southern Texas. Why? In Texas alone, you have 2.5 million eligible Latino youth who are unregistered. They represent 25% of all unregistered youth.
So getting them registered can be a very big deal.
It's closing the gap. And that's one of the reasons, for example, why Bloomberg has recently invested in us, because he realizes it's the gap. In order for us to, you know, if the progressive agenda is to win, they need to make sure that you bring in this new generation of voters. All those voters should technically be progressive voters.
Say a little more about meeting younger voters where they are. As you listen to younger voters talking about what they want and what they want to hear about, what's important?
They want to be economically viable like their parents. When someone says, I want you to figure out how to help me forgive my $1 trillion student loan debt, it's a generation that's saying, if I can't pay for my student loans, how do you expect me to start a family? How do you expect me to go into the middle class by securing my first home loan? That is technically that home loan has always been that opening to the American middle class, and that right now is shut out for them.
Maria Teresa Kumar is president of the political advocacy group Voto Latino. Thanks for coming in this morning. We really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me.
Now, public schools in and around Seattle are closing for at least 2 weeks because of the COVID-19 outbreak in the region. That has left some parents wondering whether they have the resources to look after their children during this time. Ann Dornfeld reports from member station KUOW.
Superintendent Denise Juno says the growing outbreak has made it nearly impossible for the district to operate.
An increasing number of our schools need to be deep cleaned each day because of some of the potential of some sort of student or staff contact with COVID-19. And of course, the announcement today from Governor Jay Inslee to increase social distancing and to limit large group gatherings.
The governor on Wednesday ordered a ban on most gatherings of 250 people or more. He did not order schools to close, but asked districts to prepare for possible shutdowns. Earlier in the week, there had been a growing chorus of calls for the district to close. Students and staff at one South Seattle high school called in sick or walked out in protest Wednesday. The district had told them of a possible exposure at their school and of a confirmed case at a school nearby.
They should have closed it days ago. We don't want to wait for someone to get it.
Halwa Jagana is a senior at Franklin High School.
Someone might have it, but is not tested and spread the virus.
Superintendent Juno had insisted for days that it was important to leave schools open as long as possible because so many students rely on services like school meals. But at Franklin High School, teacher Matt Carter says many low-income students live with family members with health problems or other vulnerabilities to the virus.
Lots of kids at all of our Southeast schools live with grandparents in the home and have extended family and close contact, so I just wish they'd done this a week ago.
At Concord International Elementary School, mom Roxana Rivera says the closure made her a bit worried about how the next 2 weeks will go.
Porque pues los niños no van a tener nada que hacer más que estar en casa.
Because the kids won't have anything to do besides be home. But it doesn't affect me as much as other parents. Work and there's nowhere to leave them.
A district north of Seattle closed schools last week because of the outbreak and switched to online learning. In Seattle, that's not possible, says Superintendent Juno, because so many low-income students lack access to internet or computers at home. The district plans to offer emergency food to students beginning Monday, although the details are still in the works. Juno said the district will work with the health department to determine when schools can reopen. For NPR News, I'm Ann Dornfeld in Seattle.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Forecast, mixed to sun and clouds today, leaning on the cloudy side, especially as the day goes on. Highs today getting to the upper 40s. Cloudy tonight, a few showers, lows around 40. Tomorrow, more steady showers, highs in the upper 50s on Friday. Sunshine is back for the weekend, partly sunny near 50 on Saturday, sunny in the low 40s on Sunday. In Boston now, 41 degrees. Stay with us. The BBC is next here on WBUR with the latest on coronavirus worldwide.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org.
And when you ask your smart speaker to play WBUR,
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.